wrote that for a documentary that the BBC did on the life of Raymond Carver. It's called Porky and Pale. It's my answer to Windy and Warm. Those of you who've seen me here before know that this is always the darkest moment of the set when I try to welcome you to the club, and it really is pretty grim. I've never been able to come up with anything I can live with comfortably, except the certainty that I have to say something and that I will never figure out exactly what to do about it. So I'm driven to open my mouth, and I obey this sort of show business imperative. But it's at your risk and mine. And I can only tell you, and it's the only thing I've been able to identify, really, and to talk about, that if I didn't say anything at all, it would be worse than this. So I do try to speak, and lately I'm trying to be brief, but that's even harder. When you do have something to say, you usually can't think of how to say it, so you don't say anything at all. But if you have nothing to say, you start, and then having given yourself the hunch sort of a priori that you must have had something to say, you keep going until you find out what your point was. That, of course, is an exercise in futility. So thank you for coming. Actually, there is something I can mention. I visited Faulkner's grave recently. That's not all it's cracked up to be. Faulkner, among other things, many other things, said that every man's fondest wish was to outlive his wife. So I think he would despise this next song. There are parts of this next tune that I despise, but overall I'm irresistibly drawn to this thing. Phone rings, somebody says, baby, what you doing? I've been wondering where you've been. Now and then I think about you and me. No use fighting about things we can't recall, 'cause it don't matter now at all. Just come on in, baby, we'll laugh and sing, and we'll make love. Let the telephone ring. Ring, ring, doorbell ring. Come on in, I got Mel Blanc on the radio. I'm glad you came around, I've been feeling down, talking to Tony and Mario. You know they make good conversation, still it ain't no consolation, 'cause I got love. Baby, I'll give you some, and if somebody comes, let the doorbell ring. said, ring, ring, golden ring, around the sun, around your pretty finger. Ring, ring, voices ring with a happy tune, anybody can be a singer. The sun comes up across the city, I swear you never looked so young and pretty. Hand in hand we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher man, let the wedding bells ring. Hand in hand we'll stand upon the sand. Preacher man, let the wedding bells ring. Thank you. That's become the first movement of a suite for guitar and orchestra called Ice Fields, which we first performed in Fort Wayne, thinking that nobody would hear it there. We'd be able to see what it was like. It's a lot like hell is what it's like trying to do this thing, because at least for me, it was my assumption that, and I used to play the trombone and I used to deal with conductors as a result, but now I know that they don't know where the beat is. As a matter of fact, we were rehearsing in, actually in both places. We also played it somewhere else. It's had two really outstanding performances. Kansas City is the other one. And where I realized that I was ahead of the beat, and or the orchestra was behind it. So naturally, I slowed down, and the conductor attacked me. He said, "Don't do that. I'll catch up with you. Don't do that." That makes no sense whatsoever. He has 62 people who think he knows where the beat is. I'm not sure where it is, but there's only one of me, so why can't I? Their inertial what's-its is going to be a much more profound than mine is. But evidently, that's just not the way it works. So what you have to do in that, and it happened in this piece, for example, is, this isn't the opening piece, excuse me, this finishes it. This starts it, does it? No? Wait a minute. How's it? Well, this happened also. Well, at any rate, wherever it is. You have to stay just as far off the beat as you were to begin with, and stay there until they catch up to where you are, which is like when you notice that you're falling down, you just stay right there till the ground comes up and hits you in the face. It's really tough. And it's, you know, as a result, it's sort of terrifying because it challenges memory and everything else. And in Kansas City, I remember making every error I could in the first two movements of this thing. At the end of that, thinking, well, hell, what else could, there's nothing else that could go wrong. So I'm cool now. This is fine. I've hit bottom and, you know, that I'm happy here. I can relax. So I started the next movement, and I played, and nobody played with me. And I continued to play, and they refused to join me. To the, you know, finally I just had to quit, which is not, you know, that's not highly regarded in classical music. So I looked over at the conductor, who's back here, so I can't see him. He said, "You're playing the wrong movement." And I said, "Oh, okay." And I thought to myself, maybe Bulgaria is a good place to do this suite. I am doing it in Australia, which is pretty good. It's far away. Thanks. And it was also used to accompany Paul Bunyan's slide down a mountain of some sort on a griddle that he made. Everybody lies. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Trees tonight, where little men sleep. All that snow will turn to ice while their lovers creep. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody should live in Dave's hands at Sunnyland Park and count their little days turning into dark. Won't you tell me how I could see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Everybody. Seats over there. Are they cheaper over there? I ask that every time I. Well, if I move forward, I get a little bit of a phase thing happening here, which is really sounds unpleasant. Actually, I'm assuming that. So there's a snail wandering around downtown. It gets mugged by a turtle. Goes to the police station and says, I was mugged by a turtle. And the cop says, what did the turtle look like? The snail says, I don't know. It all happened so fast. corner has some virtues, you know. I finally met this. Well, this next tune is the one that I stole more stuff for the right hand from than anything else I'm aware of stealing from. It's got pushes in it and some other things that are necessary. Pardon me. That are necessary to play so that it, let's say that necessary to play. And geez. You know, Faulkner was a pilot. He flew a Waco, which is an unstable plane, according to what I've read about it. I think it's what Will Rogers crashed in. Several other luminaries went up in Waco flames. And in a couple of his biographies, Faulkner is mentioned as a pilot, but one who was very bad at landings. So when his brother asked him what he should do with his life, because his brother had been kind of failing here and there by his own lights at any rate, Bill suggested that he take up flying. It would be just the right thing for him. So the brother, Bill's brother, took it up and in the family tradition, crashed 2 years later and died. I know, it's... This doesn't strike everyone as amusing, but it makes me chuckle. But the worst of it was, despite the family's best efforts, Bill insisted on writing the epitaph. And if you've read Faulkner, you know that he makes up words. He comes up with things like defunctive. You know, an so on the... On this guy's tombstone, there is the sentence, they bear him on eagle's wings. Bear. Why not carry or hoisted, lugged? Sort of a postmodern verb. But Faulkner had nothing to do with this next tune. He didn't write it. He didn't play it. Pete Seeger did, and I had the chance. I wrote him a letter once, and he mailed me back a leaf. He had a guitar that it had a sort of a heart-shaped sound, a triangular-shaped sound hole. That was made in England, and he drove over it in his car. I just learned this a few days ago. And has recently had them built by a guy named Bruce Taylor, who builds them according to these old specs. They're great guitars. I told Bill, you know, I wrote him a letter, and he sent me back a leaf, and he said, oh, I have lots of leaves. When I met him here in New York, I asked him for his phone number, and he drew me a map to his house instead. Excuse me. He's exactly who you'd expect him to be, in other words. And he was playing a benefit here for some vanishing country somewhere, and there was a big crowd. And when I met him, he said, where's your guitar? And I thought, oh, geez. It's back at the hotel. And he didn't like that. But fortunately, he was overwhelmed by other people, so I was spared. And a woman approached him who had just gotten married and told him so. And she had a Spanish accent. I guess she had to tell him that, didn't she? Or I wouldn't know what she'd done. And so told him that she had gotten married, and he doesn't look you in the eye, and he's about 7 feet tall. He looks off, he looks at the horizon all the time, really, as if it's approaching, and he's got to kind of keep an eye on it. And every now and then his eyes come down, and he hits you with this ray, because you get sort of lulled into this kind of lighthouse effect as he's he pans. And then all of a sudden, he... I understand Benny Goodman did that also. I'd like to see Benny Goodman just in the same room with a banjo. That would be... That's something Magritte would dream of. So she said, I'm getting married. And he said, the most beautiful love song. First, he grabbed her by her shoulder. He said, good. Looked down long enough to, you know, tell her that. And looked up, and he said, the most beautiful song in any language. And he rattled off some title, and he began to sing. And I thought, oh, this is great. But it got better and better and better because he sang the first verse and then the second verse and then the third verse, all in Spanish, all for the next, like, 20 minutes. This song had more verses than La Cucaracha. And he sang every one of them, and she couldn't do anything. She couldn't. He had a hold of her. So... And when he finished it, he let go of her. There was no apologies or anything. And she sort of reeled off through the crowd. I also met another one of my heroes, Dizzy Gillespie in Italy. It was the same thing, really. You know, more or less. So this is, Pete recorded this two or three times. It's called Living in the Country. Thank you. Thank you. Way down there, it's raining dust, and snakes police the roads. And a truck weighed down with misery stops and unloads. And 18 broken passengers, their blood as thick as mud, beg for water for anything. And the driver waves good luck. Yeah, I'll do that. Let me launch into this. This is a perfect segue here. also a Burt Camford admirer. Remember that? How can we forget it? Band from under a bridge somewhere finds an unforgettable melody, makes $1 million. Well, maybe, you know what? This is another I don't know what this is called. I'm thinking of calling this Filbert, but I haven't settled on anything. Actually, I will play it. I mean, sometimes I forget, but I'll get it in here. I wanted to say, sliding toward this end of the set, that I also have met recently in the last couple of years, couple months. I don't know. My calendar recall has long ago been obliterated. Joe Pass, who's one of my favorite guitar players. It's, just about everybody's favorite. And he's got all of this wonderful stuff that he does and knows why he does it and where it is. And if he's over here, he can get over here if he wants to. Whereas the rest of us have to stay right where we are, you know. I met him in Australia. We were playing at the 25th annual Adelaide National Something Arts Festival and had a wonderful time there. And the night before he left, we were at a party given for him by the Georgian Film Actors Studio from Tbilisi. And they, all 40-some of them, and they really like Joe because he's somebody who actually went to Tbilisi and played there. So, it's a terrible long story. We had a great time, but I remember especially this one moment. And we were there with John Williams and Paco Pena, and they lined us up on a couch like a taxidermist would and handed us a guitar after singing to Joe for well over an hour. Tears running down their faces. This was 3 days before Lithuania declared its independence. These old Russian Orthodox hymns, or whatever they were, but how would I know? But they were certainly hymns. And when they were done, and it was a hell of a performance. Half of them could sing, and half of them couldn't at all, which made it just perfect. And they handed Paco a guitar, and they we each played something. And I remember watching. I'm sitting next to Joe, I remember what it felt like when he was finished and passed the guitar to me. You really have to call on all your resources, not as a player, but as a living, as a supposedly living human being. Not to just, crumple into this little self-deprecating blob of... So you just have to... I played and I stayed right where I was. And he picked up the last couple notes that John had played. And that was his piece. And it went on for about 5 minutes. Stunning. So the next day... This, by the way, is sort of in you'll see what I mean. The next day, we were it could have been dinner, could have been breakfast. We were eating, and there was a lot of food and a buffet behind Joe, a huge buffet full of stuff. And I was madly picking Joe's brain, or trying to. And, the problem is, if you're ignorant, you don't know what questions to ask. And it gets to be really, really a challenge. But I was getting somewhere, and my wife was with me on this trip. She never comes to these things because she's had enough of it a long time ago and is not as fond of motels as I am. And she likes to go to the exotic locales, which is anywhere you're not, So Australia fit that bill. So I'm talking to Joe, and she pokes me in the shoulder, and I thought, well, geez, I'm sitting right next to her. She could say, Leo, or hey, did you, or whatever it was that was on her mind. And I looked at her, and she looked at me, so I figured it was another signal that I had missed somewhere, and I turned back to continue my conversation with Joe, and she poked me again, only this time she drilled me, and it hurt, and I turned and I looked at her, and I realized that she was choking. She hadn't, you have to know her, but she didn't want to make a scene about this. And she knew how much I wanted to talk to Joe. So I jumped up, and I don't know, this is the public service part of this. I think we all assume, at least I did, that we can Heimlich somebody if we have to. What could be simpler? I mean, there's probably there's a picture somewhere in here probably of a waiter squeezing food out of somebody. We've all seen that. What could be simpler? But what you find out when you're presented with the opportunity to Heimlich somebody is that all along, although you figured it was simple as pie, anybody could do it, you also knew that it would never work. If you had to, how could such a thing possibly work? We're not that pneumatic. There's not a, and I didn't know where to put my fist. I didn't have a clue about this. And fortunately, the person who's choking to death has a good idea where your fist belongs and plants it for you. So I had my fist, and I went, whomp. And, you know, in these crisis situations, you split into at least two people. And one of them is looking at the hors d'oeuvres over there thinking, maybe those look pretty good. And that's the one that registered the fact that or what happened, which was a squeak. It wasn't like a big wad of food flying out, which is what you'd expected. It was this little bitty beep, and it's exactly the sound that you get out of a dry reed when you're in a woodwind section warming up in like a marching band or something. I remember seeing these people do this until it's good and wet, and then you can make a noise with it other than a squeak. And then the other part of me was disgusted that I would take time out to think about all this while my wife is choking to death. So I realized, and it was starting to get kind of chilly inside my skin, that I had maybe just expelled the last bit of air she had to live on. And I thought, she was still standing and so forth, so I thought, well, I'm not doing it right. I have to do it harder, and I really hammered her this time. And again, it was just another squeak. And so, you know, by this time, a lot of many, many seconds had passed, much more than I can hold my breath, or a lot of people. And I would imagine, and unless you're forced to hold your breath, in which case you can hold it for a long time. But what happened after the second squeak and panic was setting in, and this other part of me noticed this, but even it wouldn't tell me. And this didn't register until the next day. At this moment, Joe got up and went back to the buffet to get some more food. Now not only one of the coolest musicians, but one of the coolest mammals on the planet. That's awful cool. I still can't, every time I think about that. Not to leave you hanging, when he came back, there was a lettuce heel waiting for him by his plate. And we got it on the third try, but if you ever have to Heimlich somebody, you've got to really kill them. I mean, you really just pretend that you're going to crush everything they have, and then it can work. But you have to do it awfully hard. And maybe part of the reason is that the average, because I've done some research with a doctor named Vitalis, a great name for a doctor, on this, and the average size of the piece of food that people choke to death on or to unconsciousness or whatever is the size of a pack of cigarettes. That's the truth. Bunch of pigs. That's inconceivable. Mary was way below her limit, by the way. After all that, I'm holding the wrong guitar. I'm going to turn it off for a minute. There you go. God.
Blowhard.
Okay. Thank you. They said that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shades. And though she'd act a little girl, a deceiver, don't believe her, that's her trade. Sometimes a bottle of perfume, flowers, and maybe some lace. Men brought Louise 10-cent trinkets. Their intentions were easily traced, and everybody knew at times she cried. Ah, but women like Louise, they get by. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found Louise in a row. They'd always put her down below their kind. Still some cried when she died. Somewhere to the south, I heard them say, too bad it ended so ugly, too bad she had to go this way, and the wind is blowing cold tonight. So good night, Louise. Good night. I've got a new record coming out. It's I keep expecting to find a balcony in here. I don't know why that is. It's just ducts, isn't it? Ricky Lee Jones is producing a record, and it's going to be my record label has begged me not to sing again. In the last record, that's all I did. It was all vocal. It sold better than anything I've done in about the last 10 years, so it puzzles me. So this one is, I played a couple of the things, not a long time. There will be at least one Burt Camfort cover on the record. Those things are just perfect on a guitar, the kind of mid-40s to mid-50s harmonies. Anyhow, I'm babbling what's new. Thanks for coming. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening. Thanks for the work. I can't think of anything else. Let's add a little bottom to this guitar. Not a lot, but enough, you know. Thank you. I wrote that, by the way, for John Kerner's. It was his bicycle that got busted. We were on the roof of a coffee house. We played at, drunk, waiting to fall off, probably, and staring down admiringly at his new bicycle chained to a lamppost down on the street. Minneapolis has always been a really hip town, you know. And while we watched, a cab came around a corner and crushed it. It's a great moment. That's all I needed, you know. Let me play this. This is a song that was written by the Sutherland Brothers in Quiver, who evidently were the Sutherland Brothers or Quiver at one time. It's called... escapes me at the moment, but it was a vocal. It'll be an instrumental tonight because I never did know the words. This is a... People, I get a lot of questions about this guitar, mainly what its identity. It's built by Jim Olson in St. Paul. He's back ordered 2 years right now, so... Thanks again. Thank you. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming to the second show on a week what day, weekday? Is this Thursday or Friday? That's not so bad. This is a song that I have come to associate with a friend of mine who used to, before he reformed and the other guy died, he was a bass player who used to play with Scott LaFaro here in the city. And at the end of whatever night it was that they had played their separate jobs, they'd go to Scott's room, which was black, everything in it, the windows, the ceiling, any stick of furniture, and I guess there wasn't much of that, was had been painted black. And they would drink, each of them, a large bottle of cough syrup. There was some sort of hit syrup at the time. This was, what would that be, the late 50s? And two guys with upright bases full of whatever it was in a black room. I wish I'd been there. I mean, just, you know, just to audit the event, not to... But this guy had begun his career also in New York as a cello player, or cellist, I guess, when he was 14. He grew up on Long Island, and in the family manse, you know. And he debuted when he was 14 with the New York Philharmonic, playing the Dvorak Cello Concerto. And through a long, torturous series of events, became a bass player about 3 years later. Everybody tries, everybody lies. Won't you tell me how I can see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody trees tonight, where little men sleep. All that snow will turn to ice while their lovers creep. Won't you tell me how I can see you now? Tell me why everybody tries, everybody lies. Tries everybody lies. Everybody this guy, and in California when I first got out there and was living in, by mistake, in Pasadena. And I immediately was glommed onto by a management team of Bruce and Donahauer, who didn't last very long because as a team because Sepp, the only person I've ever known with that name, Sepp Donahauer, was wandering around one day being generally disgusted with my lack of show business instinct and saw a home haircutting kit in the back seat of my car. One of those, you know, those you get the clipper in a box and there's a little boy with mom or dad scraping his head. And he turned to Denny and said, I don't think this guy's too hip. And he quit. And I took that as some kind of an omen. I didn't think that I could, I didn't think I could get hip in time. And I mean, I had to agree with him that, you know, it wasn't really that seductive. And but after all, it was the back seat of a car. And so I did. I kind of went broke and all kinds of stuff happened, et cetera, et cetera. But I had an aunt in town. And I didn't know this until, you know, from one of those, from that sort of protean depth that you're oozing around in just before you fall asleep, where everything is the same, whether it's a Chevrolet or a mustard seed, there's no difference between the two. Maybe your protean depth is different from mine, but I don't think so. And I was down there, you know, sporting about, and my Aunt Frances came to mind. I hadn't seen her, if I ever saw her, since I was about five. So even if I did see her, it doesn't count, not at that age. And I thought, I can mooch off my Aunt Frances. And I did. I went over and knocked on her door and said, Frances! As if she'd remember who I was. Amazingly enough, she took me in and fed me and so on and so forth. It was a great help, and as soon as I got a job, I promptly forgot all about her. And years later, I wrote this tune, and it kind of occurred to me maybe I could name it after Frances. What a guy. And when you touch down, you'll find that it's stranger than known. Signs in the street that say where you're going are somewhere just being their own. Nowhere is there warmth to be found among those afraid of losing their ground. Rain gray town, known for its sound, in places small faces unbound. In places small faces unbound. Some laughing, some shapeless forms. Sidewalk scenes and black limousines. Some living, some standing alone. Some living, some standing alone. I wish I could play Blue Dot. I've forgotten how. I'll do that. You know, every time I've done Sonora's Death Row, it's stiffed. It completely ruins the whole set. And I love the song. I don't know. There's just something about it that, you know, people want me to go home when I'm done with it. It's not a great thing to, you know, stick in here. Maybe on the encore, you know. Come out and eviscerate the crowd just before they take that. Serves you right. Drag me back out here. I guess. That's sort of, at any rate, so it's not likely I'll be doing it. That was written by Kevin Blackie Farrell, who's written some other, there's a hillbilly funeral that's real good. I think that's what it's called, Hillbilly Funeral. It's nice. This is a song I played last set. I'm going to repeat some of the things that are new that I played last set. This was written by the Sutherland Brothers in Quiver. It's called Lying in the Arms of Mary. Somebody asked Frank Zappa once why he called his daughter Moon Unit. And he said, what should I call her, Mary? My manager, by the way, the one who stuck with me, was Frank's first drummer. Just a little footnote that is important only to me. That's a good idea. Let me tune. That's a good idea, too. So's that. You know, I bought one of these things that tells you when it thinks you're in tune. I'm really not so sure. There's a guy in Ljubljana, which so far seems to be untouched. Everything, all the mayhem is happening to the south and east. And He's the piano tuner for the state orchestra there, and in Yugoslavia and Ljubljana, and and he's, you know, most orchestras, I'm told, will tune to an A that's not strictly 440. I think it used to be a couple centuries ago, A was like 395 or something, and for decades, everything, this is fascinating to me, everything has been getting sharper. And we reached 440 somewhere, I don't know where, and now we're inching beyond it. And I'm not certain about this, but in general, most orchestras are tuning to something a little sharper than 440 cycles per second. Maybe, huh? Say again? Ah, I'm deaf. I can't hear. I cannot. Ah, okay. I still can't hear it. See, here's what. I lost my hearing in the Navy, and anything hollered from, people across parking lots, give me your money or I'll shoot, I say, huh? I really, I have a terrible time with it, with that part of things. People, when they have something important to impart, will frequently lower their voice. A little more. So anyhow, this guy in Ljubljana tunes his piano to like 450. I mean, he's the sharpest piano tuner in the world. So people come there to perform and destroy their careers. They bust a tendon, squash the top of an instrument. As long as a piano is involved. Well, sorry, I got into that. Let me play something traditional here. Thank you. She lives all alone on a dark and windy street, in a room at the top of the stairs. She smokes cigarettes and stares at the wall, not knowing that my heart lives there. Takes me inside and helps soothe my troubles and pain. She's warm and she's sweet. Her kisses leave me weak. I love it when she touches my face. Talks about the past, the sorrow and regret. She cries about the gray in her head. I love her so much, but she just won't believe any man alive could ever care. I wish I'd been there when she was a girl, for love had treated her unfair. She'd not be so sad, she'd not live alone in that room at the top of the stairs. In that room at the top of the stairs. The only woman I ever knew who lived at the top of the stairs was an old bat. And I was about 5 or 6 at the time, and you know, that made anybody over 13 really, really a mess as far as I was concerned. And I wasn't too hip when I was 5 or 6 either. But this woman. She was a great friend of mine. Doesn't sound like it, but she just was unbelievably old to me. Because I wasn't related to her, she looked a lot older than, you know, my grandparents, who were of course younger than she was at that time. This is stuff I keep telling myself this, that I should deal with on my own time rather than in front of an audience. But she had a stamp collection. So once again, you know, I had an ulterior motive. But it was a form of romance. I got to ask to do some music for a children's special and a recording that went with it, and so on and so forth. That Jonathan Winters narrated the story of Paul Bunyan, who was a figure that was known to me from the couple weeks I spent every year in Minnesota, where they generally take all of the statues left over from Big Boy and these other used car sales where they have something big and lumberjacky looking, and they call it Paul Bunyan and, you know, charge admission. Little children approach these things and think they're having a good time. It's a grim state, Minnesota. I was sort of their poster boy one year for the Minnesota Tourism ads. They had me leaning up against a Woody. There are no Woodies in Minnesota, but they'd brought this Woody in for me to lean against as I, you know, you put one foot up on the Woody and you know the pose and you play your guitar and you look seriously into the lens in this vernal quietude. As over my shoulder, or was this, it does either over my shoulder or after I was out of the picture, there's a little knot of kids on a raft out in the lake behind me. And one of them leaps off into the water like this and blub, you know, disappears beneath the waves, and you cut to another something or other, you know, wild rice or one of the other big tourist attractions in the state. But what you don't get to see is that that kid didn't come up. Listen to this. There was a canoe behind this raft. It's a diving platform, actually, with the, you know, the director's assistant or what, I don't know what the job is called, but you know, the one who says action after they relay it through. And so they said action, and the kid is supposed to jump in the lake. The kid jumps in the lake, and the person hiding in the canoe behind the diving platform hears on the, you know, their walkie-talkie, the kid isn't coming up. Go get the kid. So they dove, you know, into the lake to find, and luckily they found this organism bobbing around down there somewhere, dragged him to the surface, and I was talking about something like this last set. But if not, this was choking to death. This one is drowning. I'm never bored. And they got the kid back in the canoe, and his mother's waiting on the, you know, his mother's standing by on the shore. And they get the kid back to mom, and the question is, what happened? And the mother says, well, he doesn't know how to swim. How badly did this guy want to be in show business? How do you go from I don't know how to swim to jumping in the lake and sinking to the bottom? This scene, Paul Bunyan has taken a bunch of plowshares, welded them together, I think, or melted them somehow, and made a huge griddle for his pancakes out of this thing. But before he has these pancakes, he rides the griddle down a mountainside. What a guy. Thank you. They said that Louise was not half bad. It was written on the walls and window shade. And though she'd act a little girl, a deceiver, don't believe her, that's her trade. Sometimes a bottle of perfume, flowers, and maybe some lace. Men brought Louise 10-cent trinkets. Their intentions were easily traced. Everybody knew at times she cried. Oh, but women like Louise, they get by. Everybody thought it kind of sad when they found Louise in a room. They'd always put her down below their kind. Still some cried when she died. South, I heard them say, too bad it ended so ugly, too bad she had to go this way, and the wind is blowing cold. Kill myself. That really belongs on the other. Well, I'll do it on the other guitar. Oh. God. This is probably called Filbert. I was thinking of calling it a picture of a thousand words, but I decided I was a little too cute. Not that that's ever stopped me in the past, but... I was talking about Joe Pass last Saturday. He smokes many cigars. I thought perhaps that had something to do with his skills, so I smoked them for a while. And this song was written while trying to recover from one of the cigars that he'd given me. I was staying in the Beverly Garland Howard Johnson's motel in North Hollywood or West Hollywood, and I woke up. I was depressed because I was in the Beverly Garland Howard Johnson. My head sort of fell over to the side where it usually hits that thing by the side of the bed, but I missed it this time. And there was this big Cuban cigar that Joe had bequeathed me the last time I'd seen him. And I thought, what the hell? And so I yawned, lit the cigar, got sick and inspired. I mean, it was that combination of, you know, sometimes it's, no, it's, never mind. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed and you crawl out of bed and you crawl out of bed. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And you look out the moon where the window is and the stars shine and the stars shine and the stars shine. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Way down below in the sun belt and the telephones and the telephones and the telephone. You look out the moon where the window is every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And some of us breathe in the brown ground where the worms clown, where the worms clown, where the worms clown. Way down below in the sun belt every day in the morning when you get up. And every night when you lay down, you fall flat, you fall flat, you fall flat. And some of us breathe in the brown ground every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. So we're all asleep in the same dream, in the snort fort, in the snort fort, in the snort fort. Every night when you lay down, every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Santa Claus, modified snow peas on the sunroofs, on the sunroofs, on the sunroofs. We're all asleep in the same dream every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. If you look in the mirror, it's your father's face and the thin grin and the thin grin and the thin grin. Santa Claus pulling up snow peas every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out. Credit card in the backyard, in the backyard, in the backyard. If you look in the mirror, it's your father's face every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And once in a while when the wind blows and the heart whines and the heart whines and the heart whines, there's tears in the bank and a credit card every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. But there's lint in the pocket and a breath mint or a car key or a car key or a car key. Once in a while when the wind blows every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And your kid has a face like a walnut from the ice cream, from the ice cream, from the ice cream. And there's lint in the pocket and a breath mint every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of them. you know, I wish I had called that something else. That, boy, oh boy. I like the song. The title is beginning to bother me a little bit. Trouble with metaphor is it stays the same and you change. There used to be, I've forgotten the name of the island here where used to be, let's see, it was involved with immigration, and then later on it was used for TB patients. Ellis, okay. There was a named Samuel Greenberg, who was evidently the source of all of Hart Crane's poetry. According to Hart Crane, I mean, more or less, well, less, but, you know, sort of one of those people who evidently had the right idea, but no cigar. And along came Hart. Who threatened once to commit suicide by jumping off a roof in Cuba, which was less than a story above the ground. He's no fool. And when they all laughed and walked away, he climbed down a pear tree that was growing next to him. The next day, somewhere along the way, as he was leaving Cuba on a ship called Veracruz, a book of matches blew up in his hand while he was trying to light a woman's cigarette. Got up the next morning in his bathrobe and jumped off the end of the boat. This time he didn't tell anybody. If you want to have a big thrill, there's a recording of Tennessee Williams reading Hart Crane, and it's an unearthly experience. I highly recommend it, especially if you like guitar playing. I don't know why. The other day somewhere, I went on a binge reading a John D. MacDonald, Travis McGee sort of murder mystery kind of books. I don't know how I got in there, but I couldn't get out, and I read a ton of them. And when I was done, I was, you know, ready to gag. It was too much. There's a theory that, well, at any rate, I thought if I did something completely different, it would erase this taste. There's nothing wrong with John MacDonald, but there's too much of him. And so I started reading Herodotus, the histories of the Peloponnesian Wars. I immediately forgot about Gunsels and 45s and things. But that book is hilarious. I'm serious. It's the oldest surviving Greek prose. And if you read it, you will laugh out loud, because it's in the first place, it's a history of the Peloponnesian Wars. He tells you that's what it's going to be, and then he spends nearly the first half of the book going through Egypt and talking about Egypt. It's just this a half a book long digression that has nothing whatsoever to do with the Peloponnesian Wars. That's the clue, you know, you can enjoy this book. There's stuff in there about giant ants that pop out from under trees. The ants are the size of dogs and go after you if you're trying to get their honey, which is best harvested at sundown with three camels, one of whom has a baby camel back at the ranch, so that the other two camels lose interest as they're being chased by the ant. And the ant eats those, but the other one has a kid back at the ranch, so it keeps going. And along with the rider on top of it carrying the honey. I got so silly the other night I started talking about Herodotus. And now my phone. Here I am. It's a hilarious book. At one point, the Persians, 500,000 men under a guy named Darius, are facing the Scythians, another 500,000 men who are nomads and have pissed Darius off terribly because he's been trying to have a war with them. He sent them notes about this. He's come months and months and months on this march and people dying and diseases and things and crossing the Danube and building bridges. And he gets to the Scythians and they stay a day away from him and he can't have his war. And he sends them this note complaining that he came for a war and how can they be so rude and inconsiderate as to not have a war? It's nuts. I mean, it's just really nuts. And they write back and they say, by the way they do this in some cases is they carve the message on the scalp of a slave. They shave the slave's head bald and they, you know, "Dear Darius, how's things? P.S. You know, and after they've mangled this skull, they let the hair grow back and they send the guy off where they shave him again and read the note. But the guy, you know, it's the perfect concealment, supposedly, I bet. But they send a note with the guy that says, "I have a note under my head, on my hair. Please shave my scalp." So the Scythians send their note back saying, "We're nomads. We don't own anything, so why are we going to stand around and fight? They're obviously smart." At any rate, here's 500,000 Persians, 500,000 Scythians. The day has arrived. They're grumbling, you know, spraying stumps and doing everything, whatever these warlike characters do. Sending each other really mean looks, you know, across 100 yards of dirt, stomping their feet. God. And at that moment, a rabbit jumps up out of a bush and takes off, and the entire 500,000-man Scythian army goes after the rabbit. And instead of Darius saying, "Oh, I've got this battle beat they're after..." Darius says, "These guys are nuts," and he leaves. He goes back to Persia. I recommend the book. So I'm going to... I played this last set, but this is a bunch of stuff I nearly have to play all the time, so... And I'll be doing it on a different pickup this set. Excuse me.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank you for that two-man standing ovation. Three. And four. I know, I've been in that position myself. Appreciate it. Well, I had a request for this. This is one of my favorite tunes, so I'm going to... This is a woman who sold furniture on television in Santa Barbara. And she had the name Mona Ray. She's still, I don't know, that's just the perfect pile of syllables as far as I'm concerned. Thanks for coming out to the late show. See you here next year, I hope. Thanks a lot.